Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with literary editor Matthew Schmitz about The Americans, the Cold War spy drama that has us asking whose approach to sex is more dehumanizing, the KGB's or the average American parents. Then we'll talk about John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, that Puritan allegory, which Matthew argues is still the American story, forgotten perhaps, but not gone. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. One of the best dramas on television right now is FX's The Americans. It's about an apparently American couple, Philip and Elizabeth Jennings, who run a travel agency and live with their teenage son and daughter in a suburb of Washington, D.C. The time is the early 1980s, and all is not as it seems in Ronald Reagan's America. Philip and Elizabeth are in fact Russian. They're Soviet spies, so deep undercover in suburbia they almost don't know which way is east. Now in its fifth season, the show has been much praised by critics. Conservatives often appreciate what they take to be its unreconstructed, Cold War-style American patriotism. I most like the way it depicts the co-presence of radical evil and bourgeois optics. There's something Hitchcockian afoot, seems to me. Matthew Schmitz is interested in how Soviet spies talk to their teenagers about sex, not so differently, it turns out, than American parents do. So Matthew, bring us up to speed on this storyline with Philip and Elizabeth's teenage daughter. What is the context in which they're talking to her about the birds and the bees?
So over the last couple of seasons, we've seen their daughter Paige become a major character with a sure instinct for rebellion. She has defied her Soviet spy parents, even before knowing they were spies, by becoming a Bible-believing evangelical Christian, and later by dating a doe-faced boy whose father just happens to be a counterintelligence officer for the FBI. So in this season, we've seen Philip and Elizabeth become concerned that Paige may end up sleeping with her boyfriend. Their concern, you know, isn't the usual one, say that she'll become too emotionally involved or contract an STD. It's instead that she'll give up the family secret, tell her boyfriend that her parents are spies, and thus expose their family to rooting out by the U.S. government.
So as Elizabeth says to Paige, she says, "It's confusing when you get close to someone like that. You might end up saying something or acting in a way that would draw suspicion." So Philip and Elizabeth, part of their spy training is that they learned how to use sexual intimacy in order to get information from people. So they understand the sort of the dynamics of intimacy and disclosure. At a certain point in the present season, it was last week's episode, Philip and Elizabeth visit Paige in her bedroom, and they sit her down for a talk. And Elizabeth says to Paige, "There's something we can show you, a technique to help you keep your emotions in check, to help you stay in control. If you can learn this thing, really master it, you can keep seeing him."
I was very struck by that scene. You know, the whole current regime of sexual ethics, such as they are, is centered on taming sex through technique. The idea is that through the dual presence of consent and contraceptives, sex can be rendered safe, no matter how ill-advised it is in fundamental terms. The idea is that if we just apply certain methods, we can make sex safe. Now, for most American parents, this is aimed at averting, you know, unwanted pregnancy, preventing STDs. In the case of the Soviet parents, they're trying to prevent the exposure of their family secret. But really, it's the same kind of safety technique that they're advocating for.
It's startling how much of this dialogue, if you just switched out one or two nouns, would be the standard American sex talk, which teenagers would receive either from their parents at home or in health class. And normally, at this point, the prop that's brought out would be, you know, a banana and a condom. In this instance, the technique that's being demonstrated is not physically prophylactic, but rather it's a mnemonic gesture that they're teaching her. They're saying, well, if you rub your forefinger and your thumb together, you know, you can train yourself to have that be a memory trigger, and you'll remember who you are and where you came from, and then you'll be in control of your emotions again, and you won't disclose things we don't want you to disclose. So there's the standard American version of this sex talk. KGB style, they're not specifically concerned with her physical hygiene, but rather with her psychological hygiene, insofar as that affects her ability to be a custodian of the family secrets. But I think that this emphasis on hygienic technique, whether it's physical or psychological, bespeaks a certain assumption that sex is really all about control and mastery. You have to master yourself or be mastered by another. And a corollary to that, you have to master your partner or be mastered by your partner. And as I was watching this Birds and the Bees scene, I recalled the finale of season 3 of The Americans, which aired in 2015. And it had this stunning sequence toward the end where there's a flashback to Philip and Elizabeth's early training back in Russia. They had to learn to have sex with absolutely anyone. So there's this montage that shows them each in very dingy rooms having to perform sexually with one anonymous person after another, very sort of undesirable sexual partners in many instances, of whatever sex, either fit or obese, 20 years old or 90 years old.
And this is a bit of a surprise for the viewer visually, because up to that point, in the way that prestige cable will do, the viewer has been titillated by shots of Philip and Elizabeth having sex with people that they're cultivating as sources. But those people, as a rule, have been pretty good, pretty good looking.
Yeah. You know, and Philip and Elizabeth are pretty hot.
They're, you know,
for middle-aged American travel agents.
And so this is a kind of unveiling of this. We see that, you know, this isn't just an occasion for sportingly having, you know, dashing sex with other people who, you know, get to wear cool disguises.
It's not James Bond.
Right.
And to be clear, none of this is explicit.
Yes.
So the point of this training that they've been through is surely in part to learn to master others, so learn these techniques of giving pleasure, but partly too to learn to master themselves, so learning techniques of self-control, right? Because if you're a spy, you cannot be disgusted by the people you're ordered to have sex with, because then you will fail to create intimacy, you'll fail to get the goods. And if you're a spy, you cannot be really aroused by the people you're ordered to have sex with, because then you'll create too much intimacy and you'll lose control and give away the goods. So that montage at the end of season 3 was really brutal. It displayed the total instrumentalization of sex and of human beings. So that montage was spliced together with Reagan's Evil Empire speech. The conceit was that Reagan's speech was being broadcast right when Philip and Elizabeth are talking about their early training. So that's happening. And I thought, wow, this series really hates Sovietism. But this season, as Philip and Elizabeth are giving Paige a minimal version of their desensitivity training, I think we're asked to ask ourselves whether the KGB approach to sex really is so different from the everyday American approach to sex. For most Americans, sex is assumed to be extramarital unless the marital context is stipulated. And that being the case, the tendency of sex to inspire self-giving, giving up the goods, is not blessed and lauded. It's feared as a loss of self-control. So we need these techniques, not just of physical hygiene, the condom and the banana, but also of emotional hygiene, such as Philip and Elizabeth are teaching Paige. And sex becomes a contest of mastery of who can instrumentalize whom.
One of the things we've seen throughout this series is a kind of typical immigrant family storyline between the immigrant parents and the first generation children. The title of the series sums this up, The Americans. In one sense, it's false. They seem to be Americans, but they're in fact Soviet spies. But there's another level of falseness. They are explicitly Soviet spies, but they tend to parent in the American manner. And so this attempt to keep Paige, you know, close to the family by teaching her this mnemonic device is, you know, part of this more general effort to negotiate, you know, maintaining a separation from this culture that's very, very effective at assimilating people.
Yeah, I think you're right. That phrase they use, this will remind you who you are and where you came from, it's just a little bit odd and not quite on point for what they're trying to teach her. What they're trying to teach her is, you know, be in control of yourself, be prudent, be discreet. And that's not exactly the mantra they gave her, but that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's about identification with the community. We've seen, as this is happening, we're also meeting another Russian couple with a child. These are emigres, scientists who's fled Russia, with taking his wife and son with him. And this Russian scientist despises the Soviet Union, and he's absolutely enthusiastic about America, and his son is reacting against that and identifying with Russia. Paige, though she's less stark in her choice, is apparently being set up to be his opposite. One of the things that's been very notable about this series is its willingness to contrast the material and social kind of plenitude and freedom of America with what exists in the Soviet Union. Whenever we return to the Soviet Union, there's a different camera lens being used and things are much darker and grayer. And we've seen an American health food store, one of the most notable bastions of perversity in our country, where overwealthy people conspicuously consume foods that make them feel self-righteous but actually have no discernible health benefits. You know, whatever, honey, coriander, quinoa, breakfast nuggets for your dog. This is insane. This is not what our forefathers fought for. But we've seen this store contrasted with a Russian grocery where the shelves are absolutely empty, but this grocery is being investigated by Soviet officials because it's actually the best one in all the city, and somehow they're getting better goods than everyone else. So this indicates corruption, and they're trying to root it out. This one display of excellence, and apparently of some initiative on the part of the people who run the store, is being penalized by the most conscientious people in the regime. So this contrast has been drawn all through the series. The contrast has tended to be in terms of material plenitude and freedom, but we have not yet seen a strong moral contrast drawn. We have heard certain things about, you know, people being sent to the gulag in the Soviet Union, but we also know that the Americans have done evil things. Right now there's a plotline about the Americans trying to exterminate all the civilians in the Soviet Union. So the contrast,
precisely by attacking their grain supply. So it goes back to this motif of food and plenitude.
So the current contrast is one of a wealthy and free West and a poor and constrained East. But that's not fundamentally a moral contrast that we're seeing yet. That hasn't, I think, been developed.
Right. And I think that there are also interesting parallels being drawn or echoes being produced between the coercions, the formal coercions of the Soviet regime and the soft coercions of a Western society. So back to this, the sex talk issue, Elizabeth in last week's episode effectively tells Paige that Paige will have sex with her boyfriend. She says, "Are you having sex? I don't care about you having sex." And she says that very forcefully because
it's assumed that her daughter will have sex with her boyfriend at some
right. She basically,
time or another. And when you assume that someone over whom you have authority will do something, you're more or less telling them to do it.
Exactly. When a mother says that to her daughter, in the tone of voice that Elizabeth did, you know, is she saying this in the declarative mood or in the imperative mood? Is that an order? And we know that Elizabeth and Philip themselves, as happened conspicuously in this week's episode, they are frequently ordered by Moscow Center to have sex with this or that target. And we know that they and Moscow Center have been thinking of recruiting Paige as a spy. So my little prediction is that before this season ends, Paige will be ordered by her parents to have sex with her boyfriend in order to get some information or some leverage over her boyfriend's father, who is an FBI counterintelligence agent. Maybe that won't happen, but predictions aside, I think that it's useful to observe that if Paige feels like she's being commanded to have sex, she's not that different from a lot of American teenagers, because as you say, when parents or authorities declare or in other ways assume that teenagers will have sex, it has the force of command. It's a demonstration of Newhouse's law that where virtue ceases to be compulsory, it will soon become proscribed. So Paige is sitting there in that scene wearing her cross pendant, and we're reminded that unlike her parents, she's in fact a Christian, and she might wish to be supported in the way of virtue rather than equipped as she's being equipped to pursue vice. And is the problem that she's growing up in a Soviet home, or is the problem that she's growing up in an American home?
This is the question of this series, and we'll see how it answers it.
Matthew, tell us the story about John Bunyan and the bells.
When John Bunyan was a young man, he loved two things above all else, playing games on the village green and bell ringing. Both these amusements were forbidden by the Puritans of the time, and he was convicted very strongly at one point of his sinfulness in continuing to pursue them. So he describes in this wonderful and excruciating passage in his spiritual autobiography, really one of the great autobiographies in English, Grace Abounding, how he was able to reluctantly let go of these sins. He says that when he first decided he couldn't ring bells, he would instead go stand under the steeple of the church and watch as others rang the bells and listen to the immense crash. But then he had a thought, what if a bell falls and hits me? So then he would go stand under the beam in the steeple so that if the bell fell, it wouldn't fall on his head. But then he thought, what if it bounces against the wall and still strikes me dead? So he retreated a few more steps and he stood in the door. But then he thought, what if the tower crashes down and falls on me? And it was only then that he was able to give up the sinful amusement.
I think this anecdote gives us a sense of the quality of Bunyan's imagination. He tends to capture his spiritual intuitions in images. You know, he physicalizes them, externalizes them, and they're often very violent images. So Bunyan wrote The Pilgrim's Progress from This World to That Which Is to Come, otherwise known as Pilgrim's Progress. He wrote the first book in 1677 or 78, and the second, really a sequel, in 1684. The first book is a prose account of the progress of Christian from the city of destruction, where he leaves his wife and children, to the celestial city. The second book shows Christian's wife, Christiana, and their children making the same progress, though at a gentler pace. Now, Matthew, you argue in your back page column this month that Bunyan, a 17th century English Puritan, formulated the American ideology of progress and migration, which governs both our individual and our civilizational narratives. What do you mean by that?
I would say that not that he formulated the ideology, but that he made a story that fit it, and he clothed spiritual realities, what we might call that ideology, in word and even visually in flesh. There can be no doubt that English letters broadly has a Protestant tendency. You know, its great age, its immense flourishing under Elizabeth was also the inauguration of Protestantism. Down through the centuries, the great stream of English letters remains Protestant in its tendency and even in its chief practitioners. By the same token, I think we could say that American letters are Puritan. they, you know, were inaugurated really in the age, you know, of Bunyan and Milton. And the men who carried on our letters, preeminently Hawthorne and Melville, were influenced by the Puritan imagination, though they were rebels against it. They rebelled against something, but they had inherited these stark spiritual categories, and they remain, I think, haunted by Bunyan, and they retell his story. Melville certainly retells it in Moby Dick. Mark Twain tells the same story, I think, a story of leaving the city, kind of striking out into the wild, the zone of freedom, in Huck Finn. You know, latter-day people, you know, latter-day literary figures like Jack Kerouac tell just the same story. It's the American story, get away from civilization and strike out into the wild. This is what Christian does in the beginning of Pilgrim's Progress. He wants to flee his family, the city, and he wants to lose that burden of guilt that weighs him down. It's that burden of guilt we've all wanted to escape, and if not at the foot of the cross, then maybe on a therapist's couch, or just somewhere out in the great expanse.
Would it be fair to say that the first book of Pilgrim's Progress is the more American book? That's the book in which you have the man leaving home, leaving his familial attachments, leaving women behind. Whereas the second book is a much more feminine book and not one that we see sort of archetypally recapitulated in the American canon.
Correct. It's a much gentler and nobler book, one more in accord with Bunyan's own very tender spiritual nature, I think. But it fails to capture something truly mythical and elemental in Calvinist doctrine, but also more broadly in the spirit of the age to which Calvinist doctrine so strongly appealed. And that was a sense of man's aloneness before God and the fact that this God might not be benevolent in an uncomplicated way. He may have predestined you to hell. Bunyan had read shortly after his conversion to kind of Calvinism, an account by an Italian Calvinist named Francis Spira. Now, under the Inquisition, Spira had renounced his Calvinism and professed Catholic doctrine. He didn't really believe Catholic doctrine. He was still a sincere Calvinist, and he quickly reverted to his old Calvinism. But he felt that this act of his under the Inquisition indicated that he was an apostate, that he lacked the sign of sanctity, which was the perseverance of the saints, this kind of perseverance in sanctity. And so he believed that he was eternally predestined to hell. Now, he wrote a memoir, Spira, expressing this belief. And here we have a man who fully professes everything taught by your rigorous Calvinism and believes it's all true, but believes through that not that he has access to grace, but instead that he's damned to hell. And Bunyan was racked by the same anxiety that he might be in the same spot. And even if you believe all the correct things, even if you throw yourself as low as you can before Christ's feet, you'd be damned. So in an age of greater disruption, where people are pulled away from old networks of kinship, where figures of authority are discredited and become more complicated, where they have a dark as well as a light face, this and a very ambivalent view of authority has a certain psychological resonance and emotional appeal, I believe. And so Bunyan didn't just capture Calvinist doctrine. Coleridge said that he never thought Calvinism could be given such a delightful face as Bunyan gave it. He also captured the spirit of an age and also, I think, of a young nation.
So it used to be the case that pretty much all speakers of English were very familiar with The Pilgrim's Progress. It used to be a work that everyone read and knew. Certain idiomatic or proverbial phrases that are still with us in the language, people understood, were traced back, had their origin in Pilgrim's Progress. It's a work with a massive cultural footprint.
When I set out to write this column about Pilgrim's Progress, I thought I was going to write a lament and point out the fact that we've forgotten it. and so have lost contact with something valuable in our tradition. The more I thought about it, though, and having reread the book, I came and said to the view that though we've forgotten what we owe to it, we remain formed by it. We have not succeeded in getting beyond Pilgrim's Progress. We continue to think that we can get beyond any and all things. That's part of the story that Bunyan tells, and something we believe to be true. But we believe that because we're Bunyanish, and no one has really put this story as starkly as he has. The book, it still has its hold on us. We may not know it, just as an orphan may not know who his father is, but his face is shaped by that man's.
Samuel Johnson said of Pilgrim's Progress, "The most cultivated man cannot find anything to praise more highly, and the child knows nothing more amusing." So it seems to me that crucial to the traditional prominence of this book is the fact that children were raised on it, and then having grown up, they found that it was a book for grown-ups too. So I wonder if we can talk about Pilgrim's Progress as a children's book. Like Grimm's Fairy Tales, for example, it has a real starkness and brutality to it. And like those fairy tales, I think it works so well for children in part because it's precisely not very suitable for them. It's sort of suitably unsuitable for children. Second point, Pilgrim's Progress seems to be a book that is just asking to be illustrated because it simplifies and anthropomorphizes these mental and spiritual conditions. So it's cartoonish in a non-pejorative sense.
Yeah, Macaulay said that in the period in which Bunyan lived, only two men had preeminently the faculty of imagination. One wrote Paradise Lost and the other wrote Pilgrim's Progress. And Bunyan has a real skill for taking these allegorical figures, Mr. Worldly Wiseman, Mr. Turnaway, and making them seem, Mr. Byans, and making them seem vivid and human. We can't imagine that they aren't real. This is in marked contrast to many people who are purporting to write realist fiction, where the characters seem merely allegorical or totally unreal. It certainly does appeal strongly to children. It's a book that continues to have a hold on my own imagination, though I've moved away from the religious milieu in which I first encountered it, in which it made more sense. Now, I was not raised as a Calvinist, just as a standard-issue American evangelical. I later did become a Calvinist. Maybe that's because of Bunyan's influence. I don't know. I know that I've read Pilgrim's Progress several times, and I've never been able to complete the Institutes. I recently found my copy of them, which I had left at home in Nebraska, and I saw where my bookmark was. It was about 70 pages in, and then I despaired. And I guess within a few years, I'd become a Catholic. But undoubtedly, Bunyan's book will outlast all Calvin's works.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Matthew Schmitz. And thank you, listeners.